The Surrealistic Perspective on Art of Gala and Salvador Dali.
Art was magic. Art was a special vision that you could get from connecting yourself to something larger, essentially. The thesis is that what you imagine is real.
That's Michelle Gerber-Klein. We talk with her about her acclaimed biography of Salvador Dali's muse, manager, and lover, Gala Dali. Then murder mystery master Anthony Horowitz lets us in on the secrets of writing crime fiction.
It's one of those genres, murder mystery writing, where you cannot fool around with your reader. By that I mean that I've talked already about everything has to make sense, it has to be clear, but the clues also have to be in plain sight. I think people get very agitated if they don't have a chance of solving it. I think in the case of my books, it is always possible to guess the ending at the same time as the detective. All the clues are there, they're in plain sight for you to see, and there are no tricks, no holes in the plot, nothing that doesn't make sense. I take enormous care with that as well. And I think also that reading murder mysteries is to some extent an intellectual pursuit. You're not just reading the story and enjoying the characters and the environment, the descriptions and the sort of, the general, story of the book. You're also, I think, analysing it. You're always looking out for the clues. You're looking out for the twists and the turns and the surprises and, of course, the resolution. And if it doesn't all work together in your mind, you feel shortchanged. And that's something I never want to do to my readers.
We talk with Horowitz about his latest in the Atticus Punt / Susan Ryland mystery series, The Marble Hall Murders. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When I was growing up, surrealistic painter Salvador Dali was a familiar figure in the art news, with his flamboyantly twisted handlebar mustache and surrealistic landscapes of dripping clocks and deserts. But I did not know about the fascinating woman who was behind Salvador Dali's success, his muse, manager, and great love of his life, Gala Dali. In her acclaimed biography, Surreal, Michelle Gerber-Klein offers an eye-opening portrait of Gala Dali, a woman who reinvented herself repeatedly, from a Russian adolescent who dreamed of big things to Parisian intellectual to the co-architect of the Dali myth. Her biography reveals how Gala's charisma, vision, and marketing genius shaped not only Salvador Dali's work, but also important cultural currents of the 20th century. I spoke with Michelle Gerber-Klein in April. Let's listen to that conversation now. Michelle Gerber-Klein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You open this wonderful biography of Gala Dali with a fantastic description of Gala with a lion cub curled up in her lap. I mean, that's quite an open, I'd say. It's September 2nd, 1941. It's Pebble Beach, California. Tell us what's going on.
They're really just in America. They escaped Europe by the skin of their teeth. And they arrived in America, and they have landed in Pebble Beach because they were avoiding San Francisco, which is apparently, or which at that time was apparently, according to Julian Levy, who was their dealer, not a town that loved artists. So they're just taking a little vacation and a detour. And they're staying at this sort of famous hotel where Gallas talked the owner into giving them a free room and board, promising them, the owner, that Dali is good for publicity. So the owners come up with this idea of doing a publicity party, and Gala wants to do it for the artists that are still stuck in Europe, because in 1941, the United States shut off immigration. Everybody from Europe wanted to come here to be safe, and they just couldn't take any more people in, so they shut it off. And there were lots of people who were still stuck, especially in France and Germany. They simply couldn't get out. So Gala figured that she'd use their fame and their imagination to raise some money for those people that were not able to escape. And so they did this party, which was really a work of art. And it was an art party. And everybody in Hollywood wanted to be part of the party. They invited all these Hollywood stars because they had heard about Salvador. Salvador made two films. He made A Chant en Danube, which is a sort of a landmark silent film. And then he made this other one called L'Âge d'Or, which was so scandalous that, you know, it made him internationally famous. So everybody in Hollywood thought of him as a film person and as an entertainment person, and they wanted to be part of his happening. So the description is a very elaborate description of how they prepared it, you know, and how many trees. They recreated a surrealist forest, really. And they had animals, you know, they went to the zoo and they picked out these animals. They weren't allowed to have the giraffe, which they really wanted, but they were allowed to have all kinds of other animals, including a tame bear that was in their forest. And then people came and they dressed up as animals in the surreal forest. And Gala was having a dream during the dinner. So her table was they got it from, I think, a film of The Merry Widow that was this huge red bit. And then they elongated it and turned it into a table. So she was in bed at table with her guests, dreaming this party in the surreal forest. And he made a unicorn headdress for her. So she was the unicorn. And then she had this lion cub on her lap, which she finally was able to feed with an enormous Coke bottle that had a nipple attached to it that Salvador brought to her on a silver tray. Meanwhile, Clark Gable showed up, Bob Hope showed up, and they gave Bob Hope one of those things with a lid. Yeah, you know, and he opened the lid and all these frogs jumped out. So that was really fun. It was filmed. It was at that time there were newsreels and people went to the cinema. If you could afford it, you'd go to the cinema once or twice a week at least. And they would watch the newsreels before the movie came on. And the newsreels were really part of the entertainment. So this was filmed for the newsreels, and thousands and thousands of people saw it. And it was fabulous publicity for the Dalis, who got themselves compared to Leonardo da Vinci, because Leonardo da Vinci party planned for Francis I. So they turned it into not just a great party that many famous people showed up at, but into sort of an emblem of their artistic genius as well.
It is an incredible scene, and there are many descriptions of many such parties. I mean, just incredibly inventive. I got, you know, I've always liked Salvador Dali's work. Not that I'm much of a student of art, but I really didn't realize the extent of this imagination with the kind of performance art that I really didn't know about. So let's go back to basics, though, for a little bit. Tell us something about Gala's background. She was born in Russia.
She was born in Kazan, which was a stronghold of the Mongol Empire. So when Europe was having the Renaissance, Russia was having the Mongol invasion. And the Mongols came and they took over basically most of the empire. And when Genghis Khan died, there were three sons, and one of them was in Kazan. And it had a famous university, and she wasn't allowed to go there because she was a girl. Women, Neo-Russians and Jews were not allowed a higher education. Only, you know, sort of white male Russians who were Orthodox. And that was the way it worked. And basically the Tsar owned Russia. So it was his personal domain, or that's what he thought. Her father disappeared. He was prospecting for gold in Siberia, and he disappeared when she was 10 or 11. And she had two consolations. She had her older brother, Vanya, and she had reading. And she was really, that was sort of an escape for her. And it was also a way of learning about a better life, you know, where your father didn't disappear and you could maybe do wonderful things and be a princess. There were famous children's stories at the time written by a Russian woman who had emigrated to France called the Comtesse de Ségur. She wrote about these kids who lived in castles, and they were called the model little girls, and they lived in castles and they were beautiful and they went out and did good deeds all day. And I think Gala wanted to live in a castle and not be where she was. So she read a lot of literature and a lot of great Russian literature. And she used that to kind of form her idea of reality and teach her about life. And then she was very close to her older brother, who became her protector, and at the end decided maybe he should be her husband, which really upset her. And she got sent away to a place for TB patients, but it was also a sanitarium. It's a sanitarium that Thomas Mann wrote about, actually, in the Magic Mount. It was called Clavidal, and it was very luxurious. But she was sent there for nervous disorders.
And that's where she met her first husband, who was also...
She met this little 16-year-old boy who was adorable, completely lost. She was the only person who could speak French with him. And he wanted to write. He was very artistic. And she had a sort of secondary school education and a diploma that allowed her to teach literature. The last Tsar of Russia had signed this diploma. And so she said, okay, you're going to be a very great poet. This is what we're going to do. I'll teach you all about poetry. And they did. And they fell in love. And then they had to go, they got engaged against both families' ideas of what was normal and proper or useful. And then they both were sent home to their respective. She went back to Moscow, where they were living at that time. And he went back to Paris. And they sort of locked themselves in their rooms and did nothing but write letters to each other, except he got drafted because it was the First World War. But anyway.
Yeah. And so we are talking about the boy who became the man, Paul Éluard, who became the most famous French poet.
They created Paul Éluard. That wasn't his real name. They invented this name. They created this great poet that he was going to be. They created it together. And when they finally got married, she had an anti-nup that entitled her to half of all the money he was going to make under the name of Paul Éluard. So they understand that she was doing this with him. I mean, they were together on this character. And they did. They wrote a number of very famous books. And one of that she was part of has never been out of print since 1926. It was a huge success, at least in France.
So this was actually the first instance of something that she was to repeat most famously again with Salvador Dali, that she was really the force behind the creation, the publicity, the magic. I mean, she had an incredible sense of style and aesthetic. Say more about what her aesthetic was, what her sense was about art.
Art was magic. Art was a special vision that you could get from connecting yourself to something larger, essentially. But her thesis, she wrote something called The Visible Woman, which was Dali's artist statement, which is called The Rotten Donkey. The thesis is that what you imagine is real, basically. And it was very appealing. You can imagine to Americans who were just getting out of a depression and getting ready to go into World War II, fantasy was incredibly appealing. They wanted to believe this. You know, fantasy is real. You know, you can make the dream come true. I mean, it's the basis of most of Walt Disney, actually. And they were friends with Walt Disney, and they made a film with Walt Disney, actually, that didn't get finished until recently. And so that was her approach to art. And she was quite messianic about it. She wanted to get it out there. She wrote to her stepfather when they were in America. She said of herself and Salvador, "We live as all artists do, to express talent in the world."
That's wonderful. You know, it also reminds me, and the way you describe her vision reminds me of the slogan of the student uprising in France in 1968, where the slogan was "All power to the imagination." And it seems to me that in a way they're inheritors of that whole aesthetic, that sensibility that began with the surrealists, of which Gala Dali was called the mother of surrealism. So tell us, first of all, what does that mean, that she was the mother of surrealism? What is surrealism?
Well, that was the name they gave her. It was a name they gave her because she inspired so many people in so many different ways. I mean, André Breton, André Breton and Edouard were really the spokesman for surrealism in France, which is where it really began after Dada. And André Breton wrote the most famous novel, which is called Nadia, which is a Russian name. It means the beginning of the beginning. It is about an encounter that he had with an escapee from an insane asylum, and he sort of fell in love with her. I don't think anything actually happened. But basically, it was Camille, but it was really Gala. The description is very Gala. So she was the center of it, and she was a surrealist woman. And when she left, he couldn't get her out of his mind. Therefore, she became a real living thing because she lived with him in his mind. And she created his surrealistic vision. Does that make sense?
You're saying Gala, who is in the form of someone named Camille.
Yeah.
And yet, André Breton, he began a journal, a surrealistic journal called Littérature. You describe in the book, Michelle Gerber-Klein, you describe in Surreal, The Extraordinary Life of Gala Dali, that she was really not accepted as one of the boys.
Yeah, they were male chauvinists. But it took her a while for them to figure out what was going on. And she was really basically, there's a famous Max Ernst painting called the Rendezvous des Amis, you know, the get-together of the friends, and it's all men, and there's Gala off there. She's the only woman. You know, she's sort of in the corner pointing, let's go this way. And she was. I mean, it was fine for them to have girlfriends who were artists, just so long as they weren't great artists and they didn't overshadow them. Gala was right there. I mean, she was not easily intimidated, I think, and very passionate about what she believed. So somehow that got through, and quite passionate about them. She wanted them to be successful.
Now, was she ever given the credit for the work that she did with them, with people like Dali?
Dali signed Persistence of Memory with his nickname. He signed it Olive Salvador Dali. Olive is what his nickname for her, because her face was shaped like an olive and she had olive colored skin. So he gives her credit for it right in his most famous painting. He signed a lot of paintings with her name. And while dedicated every single thing he wrote to her, in his every letter, they wrote letters even after they were divorced. They were back and forth all the time. And he did never stop loving her, even though he got remarried twice. But in every letter he sends her a poem for her to edit and asks her what she thinks about it. So it's an ongoing kind of partnership on that level.
But she didn't get actual public credit.
Well, it's not a question of him getting public credit. It's a question of people not hearing or seeing the credit she was being given. And it was just not in their mindset that a woman would be doing this. And so they didn't see it.
In a way, she left Paul Éluard because he set up a kind of ménage à trois between her, Max Ernst. You mentioned Max Ernst, the painter. And her, it was Éluard's idea. And I found that, you know, the whole sexual relations that went on, I think you at some point describe it in the book, or someone describes it as decadent. I mean, it's kind of, there's this kind of fin du siècle decadence about their actions, very wealthy people getting together and people trading partners and all, you know, artists having ménage à trois with each other.
I don't know how. So, first of all, they're very young. You have to understand, they're not 30 yet. They're like college kids. They're like brilliant college kids. So it has a bit of that, you know, joie de vivre, if you call it that. Not all of them are wealthy. So there's a range. Certainly, Gala had no money whatsoever. I mean, she arrived with herself. Eloire's father had made, Eloire grew up in the worst slum of Paris, but his father had made some money in real estate, so he was well off. André Breton's father was a policeman in a small town in Normandy. So he was a brilliant student, but he wasn't super rich. He married rich women, but he himself was not personally. And then there were others, you know, who came from wealthy families. It was a mix. They somehow managed to live quite well, but even though they were very anti-bourgeois.
This was a very anti-bourgeois movement, but it had, I think what I meant by wealth was the wealthy patrons that were around. It, there were very wealthy patrons, and they lived a very luxurious lifestyle in spite of their, you know, many of them, their poverty until they actually, you know, made it. It's an interesting study in contradictions or paradoxes. And in fact, you say that Gala herself was a woman of paradox. What do you mean by that?
Her body's a paradox. She's got a really beautiful body with Salvador paints over and over. She's got practically perfect breasts. You know, it's very feminine. It's very soft. You look at her face, it's very determined. And then she has these eyes that they all commented on, you know, the eyes that can see through steel, the eyes that pierce you. She has a strong nose. She's not, and a very determined look. Apparently, she had quite a masculine gait, very strong hands. I think this fascinated them, actually, because she was this kind of contradictory thing. They couldn't quite tell. It's like looking at the Mona Lisa. I'm always confused because she doesn't really look like a woman to me. You can't quite tell what's going on, so you look twice to try and figure it out. That's what I mean about her. In her personality, no, she would, because she's intelligent. You know, intelligent people aren't really one way. You know, they're intelligent, but they have emotions like anybody. So yeah, that was a contradiction. She was ambitious because she was generous, which sounds like a contradiction, but it's not really. I mean, she wanted to share what she had discovered with, she was a teacher. Naturally, you know, share what she had discovered with other people. And so that made her ambitious. Maurizio Catalan once pointed out to me, he said, being an artist isn't exactly like being a plumber. You know, if you know what your job is when you're a plumber, and you know when you've done a good job and you get paid for it, you know, but with an artist, it's much more nebulous. So one of the ways to tell yourself you've done a good job is to really sell the painting for a lot of money. And that, it's not so much we want the money, it's that we want the recognition, is what he's saying.
Oh, she was very good with money.
She was excellent.
Yeah.
And she didn't think she was either. I think that came naturally.
And she made a lot of money for Salvador Dali, who probably would have languished in obscurity had it not been that she became his muse, his manager, his publicist. I mean, she had so many roles, his inspiration. And you say in the book that also that she had a lot of secrets. I wonder if there were any secrets that you were looking for the answers to that you were not able to uncover in this book.
I didn't really approach it from the point of view of wanting to uncover her secrets. I took it for granted that since she was a foreigner in every country she lived in as an adult, she would find it difficult to explain to people what it was like where she came from, what she had been through, how she arrived at being who she was. And so she simply wouldn't talk about it. And she also had another attitude, which is pity kills strength. So she didn't discuss her problems openly. And she kept her private life private. So she didn't discuss her daughter. You know, she didn't discuss that kind of thing. When she was out, it wasn't that she wasn't friendly, but she was sort of on, a little performative.
A little performative, a lot performative. So tell us a little bit about, you know, your process with this book. You uncovered new material. And you spoke to some people who actually had never spoken before about her or Salvador Dali. Tell us about, you know, those sources and your whole process of approaching the research in this book.
So when I started reading, what I would do is I would look up all the footnotes. And it became apparent from looking at footnotes or not finding them that a lot of what was written about Gala and Salvador was invented or torqued. So I just tried to find people who really knew them and or especially Gala, and talked to, for some reason, nobody had bothered with all the stuff that was written about. Nobody ever bothered to talk to her daughter or her granddaughter, or her daughter didn't talk, but her granddaughter. So, you know, that took me a few months to get her to say yes, but I talked to the granddaughter about her and what really happened and what she was like and got a completely different story than what was written. And then she was famous later in life for having, she liked young people. She liked nourishing people. And she had two or three at least, younger lovers. And there was this one lover who was supposed to have died of a drug overdose, who was very much alive. And I had lots of lunches with him and finally got the full story of the affair out of him. And it was interesting to hear, you know. So that kind of thing, which adds a dimension of humanity to her.
And so after having done this biography, which has been very well received, I have to say, what are some of the most important things you feel that you learned from writing this?
So when I started this, I didn't really, as a young child, and actually a pretty young child, I somehow got the idea that Salvador Dali was a great artist. Then as I grew older, I got the idea that he had fallen into disrepute, and I didn't pay attention anymore. And so when I came to this, I didn't come to it loving them. And I was worried because actually some of the art looked a little garish to me. I went to Spain and I looked at the museum they built, and I looked through everything at the foundation that they had. It's elaborate, it's inventive, it's colorful. But it's not garish at all. It's incredibly intelligent and seductive. And I hadn't realized that when I started. It's very different when you're looking at an image on the internet or on the screen and when you see it in person. You get the scale, you know, you get the shades that you can't possibly see. So that it was a welcome surprise that I ended up liking them as much as I did.
One should always like one subject of the biography that one is writing. I mean, it is an extraordinary tale because Gala was a woman at a time when, you know, I mean, women are still lesser than, but far more at that time. And she was really sui generis, as I think you point out, that she was like the unicorn that she was given the mask of because there was, you know, she was a unique au monde, to quote Saint-Exupéry. So, and it's just such an entertaining book, and there's so much in it about the surrealistic movement that I think many of us have forgotten about, if we ever knew about it at all. And I want to thank you so much, Michelle Gerber-Klein, for writing the book and for talking with us here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Michelle Gerber-Klein. In addition to Surreal, she's also the author of the biography Charles James, Portrait of an Unreasonable Man. Find links to audio and text samples from Surreal by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with murder mystery maven Anthony Horowitz about the latest in his best-selling Atticus Punt series. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Anthony Horowitz is one of the most prolific crime fiction writers in the world, author of hugely popular series such as the Alex Rider series for children, the Sherlock Holmes novels The House of Silk and Moriarty, Midsummer Murders, The Magpie Murders, Foyle's War, and so many more. Most, if not all, of these have been turned into acclaimed TV series, including on PBS Masterpiece Mystery. We spoke with Horowitz about his popular Atticus Punt Susan Ryland series, beginning with Magpie Murders and followed by Moonflower Murders. Today, Horowitz returns to the show with the Marble Hall Murders, the latest installment in the series that blends classical mystery style with postmodern flair. Horowitz tells us about the literary sleuthing of Susan Ryland and the Agatha Christie-inspired brilliance of fictional detective Atticus Punt. Let's listen now. Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me, Francesca.
You know, this is my favorite of the Atticus Punt / Susan Ryland series. I'm not sure why I loved it so much. It was very complex. I think part of it is because I have now seen the PBS series, so that I actually had a vision of the characters while reading this, which really added to it.
Well, Francesca, you're not alone. You're with my wife there, who also thought that it was the best of the three, and she's the producer of the TV series. I'm very happy with it. I mean, you know, when you do a series, there is always a sort of a temptation just to repeat yourself, to write effectively the same book twice, three times. And I've tried to develop each book to make them different and to move them forward. And I'm very happy with the way this one has turned out.
What makes you so happy about it?
I think, first of all, I've really got to know Susan Ryland very well. And I think this book of the three is the warmest where she's concerned. I mean, I think she's a really interesting character. And the more I write about her, the more I like her. And of course, it's helped very much by having the wonderful Leslie Manville play her in the TV series, the PBS Masterpiece show. And she really informs it now. And because I'm so friendly with her and I've had such a great time on the set, that I think has got me closer to the character. And so that, I think, is the main thing. I think it's true, actually, also of her relationship with Punt. You know, she has this very strange relationship. She is an editor in the modern world, and he is a character from a 1955 novel that she is editing. But they still meet on screen, not in the books, but on screen. And I think that's also sort of warmed up the books a little bit. And he's become a more profound, you know, and a more complete character in many ways. So maybe, the short answer to it all is just practice makes perfect. That the more I write of it, the better I get at it, and the more I enjoy it. And I think that's what I've seen in the third book.
And so, briefly, for those of our listeners who may not know about these characters, tell us about them.
Well, I should perhaps have started with that. Susan Ryland is an editor. She, in the first two books, has edited two of the Atticus Punt novels. And in the third book, she is living in Crete in a relationship, but that ends. And she comes back to England and gets a job as a freelance editor. And what does she get to do? She gets to edit a continuation novel now of the Atticus Punt series. Atticus Punt himself is a detective, something in the sort of area of Poirot, although he's actually a German Greek and a survivor of the Second World War, where he was in a camp. And he is a detective who solves Golden Age murder mysteries. Now, this time, Susan Ryland is working with a new writer, a young man called Elliot Crace. He is the grandson of a very, very famous writer called Miriam Crace, who died 20 years ago. He believes she was murdered, and he has hidden the secret of her murderer's identity inside his book, which is, anybody who knows his books knows that they are books within books. You get two for the price of one. Susan edits a book and starts to find out the truth about what happened in the past, and that puts her in danger.
And it's a metafiction. It's not just a novel within a novel, but because these are writers that we're talking about, you give a lot of clues about writing mystery fiction in this. And in fact, in this novel, I think you do it even more so, because these are continuation novels, right? The original writer has died or been killed. And so you have these writers who were not the original. And this is, of course, Elliot is not a first-time novelist, but this is his first big chance. And so you have Susan really giving a lot of advice on how to write mystery novels. What are some of the main points that she makes and that you think are important?
Well, Eliot's first books were not successful, so he needs help, and that is why Susan Ryland is working with him. That's what she's been brought in to do, to bring him along. And actually, funnily enough, one of the most important things that she's trying to get across is simplicity. Never confuse your audience. Now, people listening to this may say, hey, this sounds really confusing, this book. It sounds complex. And certainly the workings of the book are. But one of the first lessons that Susan imparts to Eliot is you've got to keep your audience on side. So she, and I for that matter, write very carefully so that we know who everybody is, what's going on, and it doesn't get at any stage too confusing, and you don't have to go back 50 pages and say, who on earth is this character? The second thing she talks about is settings. Eliot's book is set in the south of France, and that presents problems. It gives atmosphere. I think the book is set in the world of evil under the sun, if you like Agatha Christie. It's that world of palm trees and people in white linen suits and beaches and cocktails and smart hotels, and that's a wonderful ambience, but it gets a little bit confusing when you have French characters, German characters, Greek characters. Why are they all speaking English? What are the rules of the game? So I would have said there are lots of things that Susan imparts to Eliot in this, and they're all things I guess that I believe in, but they boil down to keeping it simple, keeping it moving forward, make sure that nobody has to ask too many questions about what's going on, and make sure that at every stage in the game, it's an enjoyable read.
Well, it certainly was an enjoyable read, and I do think that one thing that helped was to have a list of the characters of both books in the beginning, because there were times when I had to go back to it.
There are a lot of characters, it is true, and it was my editor's idea, because I have an editor, of course, not actually Susan Ryland herself, but I have a wonderful editor called Selina Walker here in the UK, and it was her idea to have a cast of characters at the front, just so, because you are dealing with a lot of people, if you do need to flick to who is this character, it tells you immediately the family relationships. It is all about two dynasties. I mean, we've got on the one hand in the modern day the Crace family, with Miriam as the matriarch at the top of this family, with sons and daughters and grandchildren, etc. A big family. And Eliot, who is her grandson, is writing about a second family set in 1955, which sort of mirrors his own life. So you can see already, even as I describe it, that that's quite a crowd of characters to keep in your mind. Always nice to have an index at the start to give you immediate access.
And you not only talk about writing, but you also talk about mystery readers. And one of the things you said is that mystery readers are the most discerning of all readers. That struck me as something that you believe.
I do believe it. I mean, this comes from the experience of having spoken at great many festivals, crime festivals all over the UK, but also in Europe as well. And I think that it's one of those genres, murder mystery writing, where you cannot fool around with your reader. You know, by that I mean that I've talked already about everything has to make sense, it has to be clear, but the clues also have to be in plain sight. I think people get very agitated if they don't have a chance of solving it. I think in the case of my books, it is always possible to guess the ending at the same time as the detective. All the clues are there. They're in plain sight for you to see. And there are no tricks, no holes in the plot, nothing that doesn't make sense. I take enormous care with that as well. And I think also that reading murder mysteries is to some extent an intellectual pursuit. You're not just reading the story and enjoying the characters and the environment, the descriptions and the sort of, the general, story of the book. You're also, I think, analysing it. You're always looking out for the clues. You're looking out for the twists and the turns and the surprises and, of course, the resolution. And if it doesn't all work together in your mind, you feel shortchanged. And that's something I never want to do to my readers.
And in fact, you say that the very end of the mystery novel will tell the reader whether it was worth reading the novel or not. Explain that.
Well, because if you're reading, shall we say, a romance or a fantasy or a horror story, whatever it might be, you can read the book, enjoy it, but you can have misgivings about the ending. You can say, oh, I wish it hadn't ended that way. I'd have preferred it to end another way, perhaps. Or you may feel that the ending is too fast or too slow or too whatever, too violent, too gentle. But with a murder mystery, it's much more cut and dried, because when you get to the end, it is the final chapter, the explanation where, if it's a Poirot novel, it's that moment when he assembles all the suspects in the library or in the living room of some grand house, and he says, it could have been you, it could have been you, it could have been that person, it could have been the other person, but in fact, the killer was, and then he reveals everything. And that moment is one of enormous catharsis and satisfaction. It is the reason why you have read the book, to come to that moment. And if that that moment doesn't bite, if that moment leaves you feeling shortchanged, I fear that the whole book will have been something of a failure and you will not, I think, be able to recommend it or to feel that you have enjoyed the read. And I think that in the world of literature, it's true to a certain extent of all books. The ending has to satisfy, but I think it is particularly true of murder mystery.
Yes, I agree with that. And Anthony Horowitz, in this novel, Marble Hall Murders, you do critique some tropes. For example, like the reading of the will that you've just mentioned with the assembled group of potential suspects, and yet you use them. You critique them through the voice of Susan Ryland. I guess my question is, how does one use these well-worn tropes? What do you do to make sure that they are fresh and new and compelling for the reader?
Well, one way is to critique them, to say to the reader, look, I know this is ridiculous, it's a cliche, and we shouldn't be doing it, but we're going to do it anyway, which I think Susan Ryland does say in one of the books, and another book. I think Atticus Punt drags all the suspects together simply because he knows that that's something that Susan Ryland will enjoy. So I think the answer is to keep the tongue firmly in cheek, to enjoy all the upholstery, if you like, of Golden Age crime fiction, which includes your idiotic police officer, your very, very clever detective, this idea of gathering the suspects together, the first murder, the second murder. In other words, all the tropes of the murder mystery are in there. But because of the nature of these books, which are both modern and old-fashioned, I always have a certain sort of, a self-questioning aspect going on. You know, really? Is this what we're going to do now? Do we really believe this? And the tongue is sort of just gently in my cheek as I'm writing it. You know, I adore murder mystery. Don't get me wrong here. You use the word critique, but I love all this stuff. I love the world of Golden Age crime. I love its sort of intelligence. I love its sort of intellectual quality. I love its game playing. So I'm not critiquing it negatively. I'm just mentioning in the course of my writing, you know, can I really get away with this?
And so you do. There's a minor subplot, right? It's one of the pieces, but it's a minor piece that fits in, that involves the Monument Men of World War II. Tell us who the Monument Men of World War II were, and say a little bit about what interested you about them to include them in this, or to include one of them in this book.
Well, thank you for the question, Francesca. The Monument Men, of course, was a movie starring George Clooney, though not, I think, a terribly successful one. And it was about a true period in history when the American intelligence service brought together a group of lecturers and experts from the field of art to try and find, which is at the end of the war, of course, to try and find all the art that had been stolen from 1940 to 1945 by the Germans in various countries that they conquered. And it's an extraordinary story because at the time, Hitler was building a huge museum for himself that he was going to pack with art that he considered to be acceptable, which incidentally did not include people like Kandinsky, any Jewish artist, of course, abstract artists. He was, you know, he was much more into sort of landscapes and sort of what he would have called real art. Goering also was a huge collector of art, and all this art was stolen. I mean, it was stolen from museums, from families. Jewish families in particular lost everything, including their art. And it's a tragic and terrible story, but at the end of the day, it's also a story of hope, because the Monument came in and they did manage to find a great many of these works, and they, even to this day, you know, people are still looking for art that was stolen in the Second World War, and it is still, from time to time, being restored to the correct owners. The Swiss played a part in this too. Incidentally, the Swiss were very much involved in the art market. You have to remember that between 1940 and 45, money was not very valuable in Europe. You know, there was nothing to buy in Europe. There was nothing to use money for. So if you wanted to sort of make money, art became the currency. And I decided to put this into the book because, first of all, I just wanted there to be more to the book than just a story of who killed somebody else and about sort of dysfunctional families and wills and poison and all the rest of it. I wanted to sort of look at the world at the time. And the second thing is it comes from my time at Foyle's War. I have a fascination, and I spent 15 years of my life writing about the Second World War. And in Foyle's War, I never actually got to write about the Monuments Men. So this time I've set the record straight.
And Foyle's War was really my, you know, there, I just have to tell you that sometimes when I have a little yen in my mind about, oh, what kind of series do I want to watch on TV now? It's Foyle's War that always comes to mind. There was something about that series that was just so compelling. The characters were so heartwarming. It was just so fascinating, too. I just got to thank you for that.
Well, thank you for those kind words, Francesca. I mean, it is in my mind to rewatch the whole series, actually, because it's been years and years since I've watched it. Now, I'd quite like to catch up with it myself. But that was also my nod to myself in this book, that I had such an enormous amount of pleasure writing about the war. And this book is partly set, Marble Hall Murders I'm talking about now, is partly set in 1955, the year of my birth, just 10 years after the end of the war, where there are still, you know, hangovers and ramifications from the war. And that informs the story. One of the main characters is an art dealer, and I shall say no more for fear of spoilers.
Now, I don't think it would be a spoiler for me to ask you about the character Miriam Kreis. She's actually not a live character in the book, but she is a central part of it. She was a children's book author who everybody loved for her series, The Little People, and yet she was actually quite a horrible person in reality. And there's a one little paragraph in there where you talk about artists, let's say like Roald Dahl, who are wonderful writers, but who had really dark sides to them. And I just wonder if, what's your perspective on this contradiction that I think people have when, on the one hand, there's a reception of a writer, they love their books, and on the other hand, you know, they're odious people?
Well, Francesca, it's a very timely argument, I think, and it's happening at this very moment because John Lithgow is about to open in the West End of London, and I think he'll also be going to Broadway, starring as Roald Dahl in an absolutely wonderful play called Giant, which is about this extraordinary, brilliant writer who was also, at the end of his life, extraordinarily anti-Semitic and said some very upsetting remarks, which sort of take away from the image that we have of him. In my book, Miriam Kreis, I should say immediately, is not based on anybody at all. I have made her up. But, you know, there are many, many writers you think might have inspired her. And it is, I think, the big question of our time, which is if a performer or an artist or a writer or anybody who is in the public eye behaves in a bad way in their private life, can we accept their work? Can we read what they have done or look at their art or go to their films or watch their performances? I mean, is it possible to separate the human being from, as it were, the writer, the bad person from the good? And it's always been my opinion that we have to, because if we make it our business to say that we will not involve ourselves in the work of anybody with whom we disapprove, I rather fear that we are going to narrow our horizons very, very violently. We're going to have very few writers and artists left because nobody is perfect, myself included. I'm sure in my life I've made mistakes. We all do. And I think that we have to somehow separate them, but it's often very difficult to do that. You know, does one go to the films of Harvey Weinstein anymore, just to give one example, because of the terrible things that he did? But if we don't go to those films, are we not going to miss out on all the wonderful work done by so many brilliant directors and so many great films? It is a big dilemma, and one that I discuss at some length in the book, and hopefully make a little bit more sense than I'm doing now.
Well, now you're making perfect sense. And I think another point is, you know, in the case of the character Miriam Kreis, you know, her books, it is said over and over again in Marble Hall Murders that she brought a lot of good into the world with her books. So that almost in some way her books maybe not redeem her private actions with her family, but they do balance they provide a balance to her life.
To an extent, yes. I think her books live alone. And the point of the books is that the family is unable to say how awful their grandmother was. It's Miriam Kreis was a bully. She was cruel. She was very, very hard on Elliot Kreis, her grandson. He wanted to be a writer and she gave him no encouragement at all. She was very mean to everybody. And it turns out, as we learn more about her, that she behaved in a terrible way that I cannot now reveal without spoiling the plot. Her family is forced to keep quiet for mainly because they're still earning money from the little people, and if they damage her reputation, they will damage their own income, but also because it is expected of you. And I think this is the absolutely, you know, the core of the book and one of the most interesting things about it. If your grandmother or grandfather, your great uncle, your great aunt, whoever, is loved by the whole world, do you really want to spoil it for people? If I discovered that my favourite writers had behaved horribly, would that in some way diminish my enjoyment of their books? The answer is yes. So in this instance, they've hushed it all up. And it is that hushing up that has done so much damage to themselves and which leads really to the events described in the book.
Yes, and maybe part of the problem is that people find it very difficult to have nuance or to deal with ambiguity.
I think that's increasingly true in the world in which we live. We live now with cancel culture, where people are found to have committed some kind of offence. You know, the general sense is that they shouldn't be read anymore, that their work should be taken away and locked up, that their name should be erased, that they should be forgotten. Again, I do not agree with this, because I think that we have to learn to tolerate the badness in people in order to try and enjoy the good. I mean, Enid Blyton, you could say, is one of the models, to a small extent, for Miriam Chris. She was not a good mother. She was not an entirely kind person. And yet there are still hundreds of thousands of people old enough to have grown up with her books who do not need to have their childhood and their early dreams shattered by the realization that it was all created by somebody who was less than perfect. But as I say, none of us are perfect, and I think that cancellation and putting people into purdah doesn't really help.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one can still criticize and enjoy their work.
I think you could, exactly. It is to be aware of their failings whilst enjoying their successes.
Now, Anthony Horowitz, you mentioned a little bit about the screen adaptation of this series, the Atticus Punt / Susan Ryland series. Talk a little bit about the process of adapting a book to the screen. What kinds of changes need to be made? How do you do that? How do you approach it?
Well, you'll see Marble Hall Murders next year on television, and it's again being shown by PBS Masterpiece, and there are many changes. Some characters have had to be taken out, and some settings have changed. You talked about the Monuments Men, and the book takes place largely in the south of France, but we weren't able to shoot there because it's too expensive to shoot on the Riviera. And yet we still wanted beaches, we wanted palm trees, we wanted people in linen suits and that sense of, you know, even under the sun of Agatha Christie, if you like, that sort of flavour. So we were shooting it in Corfu. I'm actually going there in a couple of weeks' time, both to watch the shooting and I think to make my usual customary cameo appearance. So that's one of the changes. Simplifying it because, you know, it's a 550-page novel that has to somehow be squeezed into just 6 episodes of 46 or 47 minutes each. So that means that has to be a certain amount of sort of streamlining. But above all, you know, if you're reading a book, you've mentioned in this discussion that there is a list of characters at the front. And if you get lost, you can stop and go back to page 1 and just check out who a character is. If you're watching television, that's not possible. Yes, you can put the pause on and you can go and find the book or whatever, but not many people will do that. So I think with television, has to have a flow. It has to have a simplicity. And that means sort of, you know, getting rid of a lot of extraneous detail and going with sort of, you know, choosing your main plot points and sticking with them. In the knowledge that if people have enjoyed the TV show, they can read the book and, as it were, find out lots more.
And if they've read the book, they can enjoy the TV show.
It works two ways. I think also, if you've read the book and you then come to the TV show, and of course you therefore know the identity of the killer, you're watching for a different reason. I should say, you know, Leslie Manville and Tim McMullen's performances, plus the rest of the cast. We have the wonderful Patricia Hodge playing Miriam Crace, and she is just delightful. I get to see the dailies every single day, and I've been sitting at my desk with a huge smile on my face as I've watched the characters come to life. You know, plus the settings, we've got a wonderful director, the same director as Moonflower Murders. In fact, we got the entire team back from Moonflower Murders. Everybody enjoyed the filming so much last year, which finished in Crete, but they all wanted to come back. So it's sort of, you know, it's very much a team spirit in the making of it. And I think it shows in the quality of what's been done. I couldn't be happier with the show. And like the book, I think it will be the best of the three.
Oh, I totally have loved the series. Now, and speaking about the series, both the book and on TV, It sounds like this is the last of the Atticus Punt series because the book here is called The Last Case, and Susan Ryland says she's done with Atticus Punt. So
she has said that before. I mean, she has said goodbye to Atticus twice, let's not forget, both at the end of Midsummer Murders and Moonflower Murders. They thought they'd never see each other again. And I have learned in my long writing career, never say never. I remember saying that I think book number 11 of the Alex Rider series was the last one, and then I immediately did three more. So I've learned not to make false promises, as it were. I do think, though, that it is very likely that this is going to be the last TV outing for Susan Ryland, if only because Leslie Manville is a hugely busy actor and performer and doesn't generally repeat herself. So I think we probably have come to the end with that. I do have one more book with Susan Ryland in mind. I have loved writing the character. I find writing as a woman extraordinarily liberating and sort of, I don't know why, but it just changes my perspective a little and makes me rethink certain things, which I find very helpful to my writing. And I've really come to like Susan. And I do have one more idea in my head, which is set only in the modern time. So it doesn't go back into the golden age of crime fiction this time, which I fear would mean not having Atticus Punt. But I don't know if I'll write it or not. I'm at the moment doing another Hawthorne novel. I've got 12 of them in my head, and I know that my publishers are very keen for me to keep doing that. So maybe next year, maybe the year after, another return to Susan. We'll see.
You have 12 Hawthorne novels in your mind?
Well, this one I'm writing now is number 6. It's in front of me on my desk as we speak. I'm about 6 chapters in, and it's going very well. I'm enjoying writing it. Hawthorne is a very different kettle of fish to Atticus Punt. Nowhere near as agreeable. He's quite a spiky character to write. But I do enjoy these rather twisty mysteries. And I love the fact that I'm in the books as both the sort of narrator and the sidekick to the detective. It makes writing the books very fresh and different because, of course, I have no idea what's going on, being only the sidekick.
Well, I think the word prolific has been applied to you. It's almost an understatement.
I do love writing. I will be honest. It's what I mean, I've been in this room, I think, for about 9 hours today. Even though it's a beautiful sunny day here in London, I've resisted the temptation to go out, apart from walking my dog. But even when I walk the dog, I'm thinking about the book. And it is a little all-consuming. This moment in life of actually sort of writing the actual book itself, and you know, that enormous truckload of words that's being delivered to my front door, which has to be arranged and put into the book. It's a lot of work, and it consumes me.
Mm. Well, I'm so glad it does consume you, because you've made a lot of readers happy, including myself. Anthony Horowitz, we've been talking about your latest, Marble Hall Murders. It's just been a terrific conversation, and I want to thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Francesca. Thank you.
Anthony Horowitz. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our other conversations with him, including those in the Atticus Punt / Susan Ryland series. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Dolan Perkins Valdez about her new novel, Happy Land. And we also have a conversation right after Mother's Day with Nancy Reddy about her book, The Good Mother Myth, Unlearning Our Bad Ideas About How to Be a Good Mom. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.